Welcome to the Food and Faith Podcast, conversations from the soil and around the table with your co-hosts, Sam Chamlin and Anna Woofenden. We are so glad to have Mihi Kim Court with us this morning. Mihi's a Presbyterian minister, an agitator, a speaker, a writer, and a slinger of hopeful stories about faith and church. I have long appreciated Mihi's work on Twitter and Facebook and articles. And after I read her first book, Making Paper Cranes, Towards an Asian American Feminist Theology, I started following her work and was excited when her new book was going to come out, which I'm sure she'll tell us more about, Outside the Lines, How Embracing Queerness Will Transform Our Faith. And I pre-ordered it months ago when I first could. but I didn't really know how, it didn't occur to me that it would be a podcast guest until you tweeted this tweet, which I found thanks to Google this morning. you said, I'd love to chat, get on some podcasts to chat about Outside the Lines and hashtag life with kids, hashtag church, hashtag queerness, hashtag Korean comfort food, hashtag writing, hashtag marriage, hashtag theology, and what else. So we are thrilled to have you on the podcast to talk about Korean comfort food and everything else. So thanks for being here with us this morning.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I have followed your work as well, Anna, and appreciate the way you're pushing the boundaries around church and church gatherings and vocation and how to be the church and feed people and love people and care for people. So I'm looking forward to this conversation.
Thank you.
So the pleasure's all ours. Thank you for being here, Mihi. So we'd like to start. Tell us a little bit about your geography. And you can explain that in whatever way makes the most sense for you. What is your place? Where sort of do you find your community? What is the land around you? What forms you? Sort of take us into your world a little bit.
Yeah. No, that's such a great question. And one that isn't asked often enough, I think. You hear a lot about people sort of, you know, faith journeys and life stories and how did you get to where you are today spiritually, that kind of question. And all of those are super, they're wonderful questions and a great chance to sort of reflect and think about what's happening in your life and where you are. But I really love the geography question. So I'm a Colorado girl at heart. I grew up in Colorado Springs. My family moved to Denver for a couple of years and we moved back to Colorado Springs. And then I did my undergrad up in Boulder. So just really the landscape of, that's sort of the Rocky Mountains on one side and then the Great Plains on the other, that has really shaped, my understanding of creation and how to be a creature, to understand myself as created, you know, because it's beautiful, it's majestic, and people love to be, outdoors. And I definitely grew up, with my family and with our churches going camping and hiking and doing, you know, everything that we could outside. And that was always sort of the backdrop, you know, that was the scene that I grew up with in Colorado Springs. There's a huge 14er there called Pikes Peak. And that it feels like it kind of follows you around everywhere when you're in that town. It really sort of visually shapes, you know, it's a different kind of mirror in terms of how you understand who you are and what it means to be embodied. So I did want to just make a note. I think it's important to, and it's a practice that I've been trying to enact as much as possible, but to recognize that the lands that we lived in and lived on in Colorado, that they actually are not ours, that they're stolen. Mm-hmm. And so primarily belonging to Ute and Cheyenne and Arapaho nations. And I'm also mindful of my immigrant status. So my parents immigrated with me as a baby in 1979. And we moved to Colorado because my mother has a sister and her family was living there at the time. And so they sponsored us and the way those sort of traditional pathways to immigration, the way they go, you go to where your sponsor lives, and then you begin the sort of naturalization process there. So that's also in the backdrop as well. But I'm thinking about two in particular memories of what it was like to grow up there. My parents, you know, had their own garden. There's that sense of, you know, you want to bring something back from that original soil that reminds you of who you are and your culture and your identity and what's familiar. So they would grow their own sort of lettuce and a particular kind of like Korean lettuce you use to like wrap meats and something called perilla leaves. It really looks like the leaf of a tree, but it grows out of the ground, these sort of big, long, tall plants, and they have this kind of bitter, minty sort of flavor. So if you can eat it raw, and sometimes people just use those to wrap like rice and different meats and that are really savory, or you use that as like the summer kimchi, like it's a replacement of sort of that long process of fermenting and pickling lettuce and making kimchi. So this is a very quick, slightly spicy, really savory, goes well with anything that's just kind of neutral like rice. So they would grow those kind of things. And we would every year travel with our church down to Pueblo, which is about an hour and a half south of Colorado Springs, to go and pick green chili peppers out of these huge fields. And so I have lots of memories of just, running around in the fields, and our parents are just kind of bent over picking as many peppers as possible. And they would bring them up in these huge, 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 like garbage bags, basically. Lay them out on our driveway to dry in the sun, and they would turn red. And that was our sort of chili powder that we would use for spices, for kimchi and that sort of thing. So it was an interesting, I haven't had a ton of time, or I haven't spent a lot of time reflecting on that, but it feels like there's so much that's rich right there and meaningful in terms of, we're working the land, we're an immigrant community, we weren't aware of the time of the sort of colonialist projects that even brought us there, but that that ripped that land away from communities that had belonged to that land before us. So there's a lot of interesting kind of dissonances and resonances in that experience. But it's thinking about it now, I feel like it has really cultivated and formed my sense of rootedness and belonging in the world, and sort of a gratitude for what the land can produce for us, even, thousands and thousands of miles away. And the soil in Colorado is not very hospitable to certain kinds of vegetation because of that sort of Great Plains kind of ecosystem. It's very clay-like and dry. But my parents were so patient and worked with it and did what they could with it. And I felt like that was very instructive to me in terms of, continuing to be present and to appreciate, what is in front of you and making the most of it. That's Colorado was the main thing. And I visited Korea a handful of times with my family, and that's a totally different kind of, geography. It feels very tropical compared to Colorado. I don't think that's quite right, but it's very humid. It's very green. They have monsoon seasons as well. And even though I hadn't spent a lot of time there, I was born there and we stayed there until I was about a year old. What they say about how children are formed from like that first moment, that first breath that they take. And so, walking around, you feel that you feel echoes, wherever you walk, even though nothing makes sense or is familiar. There's that sense of somehow this is etched into your DNA, even though you don't quite understand it or have experienced it before. So there was that sense of coming home for a moment and feeling like, oh, okay, this is what it's like to not have to be aware of myself all the time and to try to label myself or categorize myself either as an immigrant or as an Asian American or as a woman, but to be able to blend in somewhere, that was a pretty significant. So those were the two places. And now I live in Indiana, and I'm still trying to figure it out. I don't really know what to say. being in the Midwest. It was so disorienting moving out here because I just expected flat and cornfields. Right. But we live in Bloomington and it's a lot more hilly here. It's a lot more mountainous. It feels a little bit different. So we've appreciated that for sure. And this is primarily Shawnee land as well. And so mindful again of all the different locations that we find ourselves in, and remembering who inhabited it and then who it's sort of our complicity, that our presence is even complicit in a lot of the sort of violent structures. So yeah. That's the geography.
That's so, thank you for bringing up the people who have been in and owning and having and cultivating the land. That's something that we're really mindful of in these conversations. And I think you weave in beautifully too, that there's no such thing as like a static solo geography, right? Yeah. Like when we ask like your geography, I think you just demonstrated what feels so true to me is that they're intertwined, and there's the history and there's different culture, and there, you know, and what did your family bring to the neighborhood in Colorado Springs by growing plants that I'm guessing your neighbors were like, what is that? You know, like, and that is, you know, that intertwining is always there. So I was interested, I found an article you wrote about 6 years ago. The picture with it, your little ones are like these little chubby, tiny little faces in your photo picture. About cooking rice with your mom. And I just, this quote really, the way you started it off is, it's a simple task, but one I feel I've never quite gotten right. And going on to talk about cooking rice, but then bringing in some faith journey with it. So, answer this question however you like, but I'm curious about where does faith come into this conversation about place and culture, and then specifically around food and hashtag Korean comfort food. Where does that come in, and how does your faith journey intertwine with that?
I think that there's, you know, really basic things to being human. You know, everybody needs water, everybody gets hungry, everybody needs to sleep. Although with my children, you wonder if they really do need to sleep, they act like they don't need to sleep. But they definitely, they remind me of the way that the very basic, you know, hunger and thirst, that those are the things that really kind of level the playing field for everybody. You know, those are the sort of great equalizers. And so communion and the table, I feel like is something that has really framed my faith and how I move and live and walk through the world. The thing with communion, though, it feels like it's a very sort of recent kind of thing for me, just because I didn't grow up with it. So in a Korean, in most Korean immigrant churches, you know, you have sort of the two separate worshiping communities with the first generation, like my parents' generation, they worship together. It's like the grown-up church and it's in Korean, and the kids all worship totally separately all the time. So I didn't take communion until I was in college. I maybe took it when we got confirmed, but I'm not even totally sure about that. I can't even remember that, really. I just remember a lot of questions that day. and it's a kind of test that, you know, you have to, you know, recite like the Lord's Prayer and, you know, all those things, you know, maybe typical for our generation and not so much for our kids today.
Can you explain sort of these two communities and sort of the genesis of that and sort of why that plays out that way?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So I imagine that it's not, you know, it's not singular to just like Asian immigrant communities. I mean, imagine like all sorts of communities where the primary language isn't English, that this probably happens in a lot of faith communities. But so the church that I grew up in, it really was based on language and this sort of sense of there's a hierarchy between people based on age and gender and season of life, So, you know, yeah, so definitely all the first gen and all the Korean speaking and adults would worship together and just, you know, like a regular worship service, you know, what we're familiar with. And then children and young people and second generation and English speaking, they would have completely different worship services. And again, it was just based, it really was just mostly based on language in terms of what could be communicated and understood and how things were engaged. You would think that it would be an easy thing to bring children into the worship service and do some translation work and that kind of thing, but it never really happened. And I think a lot of that was that sort of hierarchical kind of structure to the church where children and young people were just kind of on the at the bottom of the totem pole, for lack of a better metaphor. That's a terrible metaphor. But we're just sort of at the bottom of the community and just not necessarily taken for granted or unappreciated, but there was just a sense of like everybody had their place. Sure. And so that was enacted in church community and in worship services.
And so I'm trying to sort of enter into your space. So is the table, yeah, the communion table, the way that those two sort of these, I don't want to say two communities, but kind of these, okay, the way this community is understood, is that the way to sort of bridge these sort of two groups that by being confirmed, you kind of moved into a different space?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it did give us this sense of like, now we're becoming a part of the church and not, you know, practicing or learning or being instructed first. And then it definitely felt like a invitation and sort of affirmation. But then we never took communion with them after that because the worship services were always totally separate. So there was never this posture of like, oh, you know, we're having communion, we should invite the children up or those young people who were confirmed. That just never crossed adults' minds. But then again, also in Korean immigrant churches, they practice communion. I mean, they celebrated communion very rarely. It was one of those kind of on the opposite end of the spectrum in terms of just like, you know, it was such a special and an important kind of moment and sacrament that it wasn't to be done regularly and sort of take away from the sort of sacred meaning of it, you know, which I go back and forth. I mean, I get where and I understand sort of where they're coming from, but I feel like we really missed out. And so, you know, the places like in college that where I was able to experience it more, like at the Presbyterian church that I joined up there. And then I on Wednesday evenings went with a friend to an Episcopalian church and, you know, we would celebrate the Eucharist there. And that was the first time I had that kind of experience, you know, drinking from the cup and it being wine and I'm 19 and very confused. and then even seeing a woman priest, I mean, that changed everything for me as well. So yeah, I mean, those were the places. So the table continues, I think, to be a radical space for me. And I know it's fraught with so many problems and in terms of who owns the table and who's the head of the table. If we're thinking about our sort of relationships within our culture and society. But I've got to hold on to something. And I still believe that what Jesus did with the table, and not just in terms of you know, instituting the Lord's Supper and that kind of thing, but the table fellowship that he embodied with the least of these and with and the way he sort of changed the positions around the table and said, you know, whoever wants to exalt themselves will be humbled, et cetera. You know, like just kind of really flipping the script and the norms around the table. I still feel like that there's something really powerful and important about gathering around the table. And so you know, I'm not in ministry, in like formal ministry. Like I was doing campus ministry for about 5 years. And then I started, the PhD program in the fall and had to step down, for the sake of sanity for myself and for my family. But it still feels like that's really embedded in everything that I do. I mean, I still work with undergrads, my cohort is all 15 years younger than I am. So there still is this sense of like, through the table, I'm able to minister and I'm still able to embody and enact my sense of vocation, which is caring for people and gathering people around the table and gathering around our differences and our questions. And what better way than with eating? Because I love to eat, and most of the people I'm around love to eat as well. So it's great opportunities to do what Jesus did, and that's to gather often and to gather across some of those unexpected connections.
Do you have any current stories of where you've seen that change things for you? For you or for or for some people you're working with? Or I'm also thinking, I mean, I know you write and tweet a lot about life with kids. Is there a way that the table shows up in your current family?
Oh, I'm sorry. It kind of cut out for 1 second. So I was trying to catch up and try to.
Sorry, this is technology.
Totally. I remember like early on, you know, those moments where you can't get to church. It's like a miracle if you can show up in the first place. But like those Sundays where I couldn't, and I've blogged about this before and I've probably written about this in other places, but just the way that kids really sort of broaden your experience of the table and what communion looks like. And so it felt like on some Sunday mornings, I would just have to make up a worship service, you know, like we would tinker around on the piano, we would sing songs, we would maybe listen to like the Andy's father is also, so my father and Andy's father also both ministers. So sometimes I would listen to like a sermon off of the website or some other website. And then I would say that we would have communion together. We would have crackers and we would have juice. And I also think about the messiness of the table, that there's such a wonderful kind of tension between, you know, the kids, when you have meals with children, versus the table on Sunday mornings, for the most part, in a lot of more traditional settings where everything is just so pristine and orderly, and the little pewter cups or, you know, or even the plastic cups, you know, and those perfect circles and their trays and the perfectly cut squares. I love the messiness of communion with children and the sort of table fellowship with children. Where it feels, I don't know, if that to me feels more natural, feels more embodied in sort of our created self, where we're just like, we're hungry and we're going to eat. We're going to be grateful for that food. But we've had our kids participating in communion on a regular basis at Andy's church from when they were pretty young, because we really believe and want to hold on to that. The belief is formed, that belonging, belief is formed in a community of belonging and in that experience, as opposed to some kind of mental or intellectual kind of affirmation. Because I mean, even as grownups and adults, like how do we even like, you know, sort of stumble over and flail trying to understand, and articulate what is exactly happening at the table whenever we, you know, gather around it. So we didn't want to prevent them. And so it's been a really neat sort of cultural thing, because we see a lot of other kids in the church doing it as well. And they're loud and irreverent. And they're just like, you know, like, I want more. And then they're like slurping and sticking their tongue in the plastic cup. So to watch them, I feel like that there's something sacramental even in experiencing communion through them and with them. That I've really loved and appreciated, you know, and then afterwards they're like, this is boring. Are we done yet? You know, everything.
They can say the things that we can't.
Exactly. Yeah. Like, God. So I really love that. I've really appreciated that. And those are little glimpses of what the kingdom, I feel like, that we're called to be in and to be a part of and to bear and to share and to cultivate. And to plant wherever we can. It's amazing that it's the way, again, that kids are, that my kids like lead me to do that. And
Well, you know, watching sort of your joy in telling these stories and just sort of the the holy chaos that sometimes happen around the table just kind of reminds me of the book that you've got coming out. And we're really excited to give you an opportunity to chat about that a little bit. The book is called Outside the Lines, How Embracing Queerness Will Transform Your Faith. And you talk in your very first chapter about sort of this God who desires us and this God who is, you talk about desire as an adjective and that he is a God is a desiring God, which just really just grabbed me, particularly in a moment when I needed to read that. So I'm grateful for that. But you talk about, in there, you talk about that, and I'd like to quote a little bit and then just kind of have you reflect on your book and how this quote might inspire those of us who are working in place. As you say, the people who first started talking about queerness didn't do so in ivory towers. Concepts of queerness came out of flesh and blood lives, from broken hearts and crushed spirits, from the ordinary material of everyday life. So it is the streets and neighborhoods, workplaces and schools, parks and playgrounds, courthouses and churches that I'm concerned with in this project. It is where people reside in those spaces, how people interact and comprehend one another, reading bodies, lives, and stories. And so this desiring God in place is just what grabs me so much about these concepts that you're putting out there. And so can you talk to us a little bit about sort of queerness in place and how those things intersect and what queerness has to say about those of us who desire to live in place?
Yeah. Oh my goodness. That's really great. I love that. I mean, I think that for me, queerness has given me a way to think about our bodies and how much our bodies matter. So, you know, there's those sort of theological resonances there with incarnation and ecclesiology, even like, you know, how are we present and rooted and embodied in our communities, and how do those communities shape us and cultivate us? And so I love the thought of extending it to how we understand place. And I think about the sort of material aspects of place, like the table, like the font, like the pews, and then just, you know, the ordinary everyday, like our homes and our kitchens. And so I think there's a sense of queerness being a way to help us orient ourselves toward the flesh and blood and toward how we can be really present and aware of and cognizant and be okay with being emotional and emotive and just sort of the affect of these sort of places, how they impact how we see ourselves and how we see God. I mean, it took me a really, you know, it was a process. You know, I keep on telling people that it was this book that helped me to take that sort of one step closer to who I am. You know, that sort of revelation that's always in process. Like, revelation for me is never just sort of instantaneous. It's always this kind of becoming and living into and coming to myself. And so the book was a way to kind of come out as well for myself and for friends and family, and in a way to in sort of a creative, what I'm hopeful is a creative kind of way of rendering who I am and making that accessible and palatable to the world. But yeah, so I mean, I think of I talk about queerness in that introduction as three things. I mean, there's always that tension and contradiction in queerness. Like, as soon as you try to contain and categorize queerness, then are we really doing queerness? You know, are we right. doing something to queerness in a way that actually diminishes it or dilutes it? Or and so I always want to like sort of highlight that, but we still have to use words, and we have to use the stuff that we have in front of us to try to talk about things. And so I talk about queerness as posture and as playfulness and as practice. So just, you know, it's all the stuff that helps us understand ourselves and understand our relationships. And again, for me, that's just been a way to understand our humanity and the place of our humanity in this world and in our intimacies and our relationships and in our desires and our pursuits. That's just kind of a working out. That's what I'm trying to work out in the book, and allowing for a lot of different realities and contexts to be present, so that it's not just some sort of abstract theory or a concept, but that it's present in the ordinary and everyday stuff of our lives. And most certainly, hopefully, in church, because I think that Jesus is queer, and I love that. Yeah. That to me was super revolutionary when I came across some of those writings that suggested that. So, yeah, I love that question. I'm going to have to think about that some more, Sam, about queerness in place.
I don't know if you I've only read the first chapter in the intro so far, as I don't know if you work with this in the book or if you could speak to it, but where does queering the table come into that conversation? Are you wrestling with, or could we put you on the spot and ask you to wrestle with with
that? Yeah, for sure. I mean, it pops up it doesn't pop up very specifically, like with its sort of own subtopic in a chapter, but it pops up here and there because I talk about the interaction between Jesus and the Syrophoenician woman, who comes to him asking for healing and help. And he's like, I came here for the children of Israel. And, you know, she comes back with that really smart sort of retort. And that I felt like really shifted Jesus's ministry. And then he realized, oh, okay, I just got clarity about my mission from the woman and person that you would least expect. And she's underneath my table, basically. So there was something about, again, queering the table that broadened my understanding of the table and sort of the reminder of some of the politics of difference around the table. We just kind of think like, oh yeah, everybody has a, you know, we have this awesome table. Everybody has a seat at the table, but no, actually not everybody does have a seat at the table. And some people work really hard to get under the table, to find the crumbs under the table, to get those morsels. So what do we do with that? And how does that instruct us? And so instead of just kind of taking it as a straight story of, oh, this woman's faith, you know, which, I mean, Jesus does definitely highlight like, oh yeah, you know, you did something really awesome here. I think that that can be something challenging for us, to make us think about the way that we don't provide seats for everybody at the table, and that we are to be instructed by people who are not seated around the table in a way that we expect, and the way that even their very presence can challenge us to shift how we understand what that table does and what that table means. But yeah, there's a lot more there. I think that, yeah, that's so great. I'm gonna have to write this down for later because I haven't spent a ton of time thinking in those terms. But again, yeah, I really love the thought of queerness and place and table and the ways those things intersect. It's really beautiful.
Well, we'll just have to have you back on again. When you've done some more thinking,
yeah,
just let us know when you're ready, and yeah. we'll be ready to listen.
Okay, that's good.
So as we sort of come to the end of this, yeah. So tell us, you know, give us your book's coming out, I believe, in July. I think is when it's finally released. And so tell us a little bit about where it's going to go, and sort of prep some of our listeners for the journey.
Yeah. Okay. So it's coming out July 1st. And I really just kind of in the book, just sort of journey throughout my life and in my communities, in my relationships. So everything from children and family to marriage to purity to church. Did I already say church? I feel like I probably do a lot of church stuff in there. Stories about Jesus. I talk about promiscuity in there. I try to do some version with the John Piper stuff and Desiring God. I take on Elizabeth Elliot, even, you know, all those things that maybe we grew up with that shaped and sort of gave us the scripts for how to be in relationship with people. I talk through, what it was like to work through coming out with Andy, with my husband, and what that means, and what that means for our family and how we raise our kids. And so it really kind of just goes all over the place, because I think that for me, writing has always been, again, just sort of a coming out at so many levels, just a kind of coming to myself and a coming to a better understanding of who God is and who God is in the world. And so it always feels pretty experimental and conversational. Like I never think that what I'm putting out there is going to be really revolutionary or revelatory, that it's just a part of the conversation I'm entering into. I hope conversations that people have started. And then I hope that it generates conversation, that people come up with some questions and then come up with their own stories and their own projects that further, you know, this notion of queerness and faith and spirituality. I just love to be a part of it. I love to be a part of that conversation. So hopefully it's helpful and meaningful.
It certainly is. And certainly there's going to be a lot of conversation. One of my favorite parts of reading your first chapter was getting down to the notes and realizing that you were going to set John Piper next to the movie Fire. And I'm like, this book, yeah, I need to read the rest of this book. And certainly our conversation today, you know, has set so many things next to one another. And we're just grateful for the ways that you are lending your voice with its own unique timbre to the conversations that we're having. So really, really grateful for the work you're doing and look forward to the book coming out.
Awesome. Thanks. Appreciate that.
I ditto all of that. And I also just appreciate your generosity, because I know it's not easy to do the work of writing when it's also the work of discovering and being being vulnerable to share your stories. So thank you for all of the things that you are behind the scenes that, you know, I don't know what it's true for you, but I know for me, the therapy and the spiritual direction and the conversations and all the pieces that get to the point where you are willing to share. So thank you for that.
Thanks for saying that.
We like to end our podcast with asking our guests, what brings you hope? And we like to just frame hope not as something that is separate from struggle or despair, but the thing that keeps you going, the thing that gets up in the morning, the thing that that you feel like God is, or whatever, however you would word it, but that the Spirit keeps calling you towards. And I just want to give you a chance to leave our guests with a word of what brings you hope.
Yeah, no, that's great. I mean, I think that these spaces that allow for both hope and struggle to be present simultaneously and together, and sometimes even hope being draped in that struggle. I was really moved and formed by a book this year that I read in my program by Joseph Winters. He's a professor at Duke, and it's called Hope Draped in Black. And so he's really in that book trying to push against this notion of hope being rooted in American progress and narratives of exceptionalism, and that's totally not people's story, basically. And I think I appreciated that permission giving for me personally. I mean, it was, you know, just a completely wonderful and creative academic work. But for me, personally and spiritually and emotionally, it was a good reminder that I can show up and simply be who I am and not worry about having to put on a certain affect or smile or face or energy or persona or spirit, but to simply come just as I am. And so I have people in my life who do that and embody that in wonderful ways and give me space to do that. And so that definitely sustains me and keeps me, like you said, getting up in the morning and being called out into the world and called out to this work. And I think we take it for granted for sure that that hope is this sort of stuff of the journey. You know, it keeps our feet going. And whether we're looking up or we're looking down at our feet and trying not to trip, I think there's something about hope that continues to give us the fuel to continue on. And then I always have to just do a shout out and keep on giving thanks for my family, for my husband and for my kids and for, God, it is ugly. It's just horrible and messy and complicated. But it's super beautiful, you know, not to be so cliche, but it really is, it's gorgeous. And so, I think ultimately the kind of feeling of creativity and art that happens around kids and around family, in the smallest and sort of bigger things, you know, whether it's big art projects or even just a small, like our walls are covered, you know, in dirty handprints and, I'm just looking around, and you know, marker, they always find the Sharpies, which is super unfortunate. You would think I would learn by now. But I really believe that the thing that's going to heal our world is going to be the art, you know, it's going to be the artists and, the gardeners and the poets and the cooks, the potters and the weavers and the writers. So yeah, that's the stuff. I'm getting fed by that, and that keeps me going.
Fantastic.
That's the stuff.
Well, Mihi, just real quick, where can people find you and follow you? Obviously, they can pre-order your book on Amazon, but any other places where you write or social media?
Or at your local bookseller.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah.
Thank you. Sorry.
No, that's great. I'm trying to work with them. So there is the Book Corner in Bloomington, Indiana, which is where I'm located again. You can pre-order the book on Amazon or at Barnes & Noble. And then website. I haven't done a ton of blogging as of late. But mihikimcourt.com is sort of the place, like kind of the main hub for information about where I might be. I'm doing a little bit of speaking, not a ton. And then in terms of writing, pretty much just on Twitter, you know, just find me on Facebook or on Twitter. And then on Instagram, you know, you can kind of get a glimpse of what family life is like for the most part. But a little bit of what I'm seeing and doing. So,
very good. Yeah.
And we'll have it in the show notes, but do you want to just say out loud your Twitter and Facebook handles?
Yeah. So Twitter is Mihi Kim Court, just all one word. And then Instagram is M Kim Court. And then Facebook is the same thing, Mihi Kim Court.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Well, thanks so much for the conversation. And we would love to have you back on when again and to talk more after your books come out. And if you keep, you know, if you get to the point where you say, oh, here's another food and faith moment.
Yeah, for sure.
We would love to have you. And thank you for being one of our inaugural guests. And thanks for your work.
Yeah,
I love
so
it. Thanks so much. Yeah, thanks for this space. Appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to the Food and Faith Podcast. Our collaborators are Wake Forest University School of Divinity, Plainsong Farm, Garden Church, and The Keep Until. And the music is by Paul Diemer. Follow along and keep up to date with the podcast on Facebook at Food and Faith Podcast, Twitter and Instagram at Food and Faith Pod, or on our website at foodandfaithpodcast.org.